Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History and Stuff podcast. I am back after almost a month, and I have got a little time to record an episode for you guys. So, I decided what to record today after a poll I uploaded to social media, and you seem to be most interested in the history of Saudi Arabia. So, I will give you a short overlook at the history of that place, although I will start quite a bit before the modern Saudi state. So here we go. The Arabian Peninsula has long been a place where great empires tended to kind of end their territorial expansions. Both the Romans and the Sassanids stopped short of conquering the Arabian deserts and were satisfied with trading with the inhabitants of the land, as well as conquering some of the coastal areas and sometimes setting up vassal states in the area. At this time, the inhabitants were mostly polytheistic Bedouin Arabs who were both nomadic and sedentary. There were also groups of Christians as well as Jews, as well as many Zoroastrians and other religious traditions in the area. So it was a very diverse place with a lot of different groups. Among these groups were the Nabataeans, who are most well known for their buildings at Petra. And although they were polytheists, they later converted mostly to Christianity. And there are still some of their archaeological leavings in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, as well as modern-day Israel. The northern part of the Arabian Peninsula was also at times occupied by the Roman Empire, so there were also some interactions there. The Byzantines would later take over this part of the Roman Empire as well. The region had also become home to a number of Persian client states in this period, mainly in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. And there was no unified rule in Arabia at this time, so that was a little bit easier for them. This brought further influence from Zoroastrianism, which was the dominant religion of Persia at the time. And Zoroastrianism is a very interesting religion. It is considered a monotheistic religion, or I would say that it's more of a dualistic religion, since it has a dark god and a light god that sort of constantly fight with each other. And it's not like in Islam or Christianity, where the devil is clearly playing second fiddle, but they are sort of comparable, and you really have to fight in order for the light god to win. And it also has a lot of things to do with fire and things like that. It's a very fascinating religion that had a lot of impact on the concept of monotheism that would develop in Christianity and Islam. But the area of Arabia can't really be said to be of much prominence before the caliphate was born in the region in the 600s, and then mainly in the western region of Hejaz around the cities of Medina and Mecca. And of course, this caliphate grew to encompass much of North Africa, as well as the Persian empires, and even further on to modern-day Spain, as well as regions in Central Asia. And the empires in Persia and the Byzantines have been weakened for fighting with each other, and that made the conquest a lot easier than it otherwise would have been, since they were busy fighting each other rather than uniting against the new foe. And even though the capital of the caliphate was mostly in Damascus or Baghdad, the region of Arabia still remained of high importance, mainly since the Arabic language was spoken across the empire. Many of the rulers were, of course, Arabic. And the main holy site of Islam was also located in Arabia, such as Medina and Mecca. Throughout the years, the caliphate splintered, however, and central control was lost, even though they would still often nominally claim to be subjects of the caliph. They were pretty much their own states. And among these famous states were the Fatimids that fought against the Crusaders, as well as the Ayyubid dynasty, which was ruled by the famous Saladin in the 12th century. But otherwise, we see the Ottomans coming onto the stage in the 13th century and even more in the 14th century. And they eventually capture much of the coastline of Arabia, especially the most important region of Hejaz, containing Mecca and Medina. And again, they stop short of conquering the entire Arabian Peninsula. They mainly keep towards the coastlines. And this, of course, also gave them the ability to proclaim that they were the protectors of Islam, since they were the guardians of the holy sites. And of course, the Ottomans were also Muslim, but they were not Arabic. And the Turks would hold on to this region for a very long time. It was pretty stably in their hands all the way until World War I, when we see the Arabic Revolt, made famous by, among others, T. Lawrence of Arabia, who convinced the Arabs in the area to revolt against the Ottomans in exchange for a new state that would be an Arab state that would control basically all of Arabia, as well as some regions in Syria and Iraq. And although this was, of course, betrayed, the British were famous for giving promises that they later would renege on. But the Arabs were given a small state in the Hejaz, in the western part of Saudi Arabia. But this was not the only state in Arabia at this time. Another state called Nejd was also important, and it was ruled by a family called Al Saud. And yes, that is the same Saud that would name Saudi Arabia. The state was also in the region today called Nejd, centered around the city of Riyadh in eastern and central Arabia. And it had been built over a number of years throughout conquests. The House of Saud had also had a number of other states that had collapsed in Arabia before, all the way back to the 1700s, where the House made a pact with the Wahhabi religious movement. And this movement remains the main religious controlling power in Saudi Arabia today. And they sought to purify Islam and had a special emphasis on the oneness of God, which I think is called Tawhid. And they were also against all forms of idolatry, as they saw it. So, for example, tombs of famous prophets or imams were not to be visited, and shrines and things like that were a big, big no-no. And they managed to conquer the Hejaz, as well as the other regions that make up Saudi Arabia. And after a few name changes in 1930, they were basically just called Saudi Arabia and had pretty much the borders that we'd see today. The region was one of very few that escaped being a European colony throughout the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries. One of the reasons for this may be the geography, that it was a very desolate place, mostly desert and not very arable land. There wasn't really any known natural resources, and it wasn't really highly populated in a lot of places. But that would later change, because in 1938, Saudi Arabia struck oil, and of course, this was a great opportunity for the fledgling state, which was otherwise pretty limited by geography. And the new source of revenue would help complement the small agricultural and pilgrimage-related income that already existed. The oil fields were largely developed in the 1940s, starting in 1941, with a large cooperation from the American government, and they founded the company called Aramco, the Arabic American Oil Company, or something like that. And a deal was struck that America would have access to Saudi oil cheaply, and that America would politically support the Saudi state. And this deal is pretty much still in effect until today, like 70 years later or so. Saudi Arabia is still a very close ally of America. The economic development in Saudi Arabia, of course, led to a great influx of many foreign workers, both in the oil fields, but also as builders or as domestic workers. This coincided with a growth of xenophobia that had already existed, but become much more highlighted since there were many more people to become xenophobic against, basically. And in the 1960s and 70s, the Cold War also started to affect the region. And Saudi Arabia wasn't that invested in the Israeli-Arab conflict. They didn't really send that many soldiers in the Six-Day War or Yom Kippur War. But they were involved in a war in Yemen between the monarchists and the republicans. And they backed the monarchy, unsurprisingly, against the more Soviet-inclined Egyptians that backed the the Republican movement. And although the relationship to America was mostly solid, it wasn't completely solid, and the kingdom participated in the 1973 boycott of America that followed the Yom Kippur War. This led to skyrocketing prices for oil in America, and it's mostly just known as the oil crisis in the US. But as the 70s moved on, another few events led to great shifts in Saudi policy, both domestically and in foreign policy. The first of these is the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which was seen as a big disturbance, since the previous Iranian government had been pretty secular and an ally of America. The new government was much more hostile to the Americans and to the Saudis. And the Saudis feared that this would lead to a rebellion of the Shiite minority in the southeast of the country. And there was also protests as well as riots in this region. Although there weren't only religious reasons for this, they also protested against the curtailment of human rights, which was, of course, considerable. The second momentous event was the seizure of the Grand Mosque in Mecca in 1979. And this event could have led to so many different results, and I find it very interesting that it led to the particular one it did. It started with a number of radical Islamists, an Islamist movement, declaring the return of the Mahdi, and they decided to seize the holiest site in Islam, which is the Grand Mosque in Mecca that contains the Kaaba. The militants wanted a more strict interpretation of Islam to prevail, and they wanted to ban television and expel all non-Muslims from Saudi Arabia. And they viewed the Saudi regime as being decadent and having, you know, decaying social moral values. And these extremists with arms captured a lot of hostages in the mosque and managed to secure it. And the response of the Saudi government was not very effective. The army tried to retake the mosque, but failed miserably, leading to a lot of casualties. And they were forced to call in a French help from the special forces unit of the French army in order to recapture the mosque. And an interesting problem occurred, since the soldiers weren't Muslim and only Muslims were allowed in Mecca, but the soldiers agreed to convert to Islam in a ceremony before entering Mecca. And these French forces, along with Saudi forces, and according to some sources, Pakistani forces, managed to retake the mosque, although it came at the cost of the death of hundreds of hostages, militants, as well as soldiers, before the extremist forces would eventually surrender. And the surviving extremists were very violently dealt with. All of them were executed very publicly. for a number of crimes, including murder and the theological erring of having prematurely declared the return of the Mahdi. However, the outcome of the seizure was not a total failure for the goals of the movement, although they were all dead. Their goals were mainly fulfilled. Since the king decided to give more authority to the religious police, the mutawas, as well as to the ulama, the religious governing body. He also decided to ban cinemas, as well as greatly restrict women's freedom. And a lot of these policies are still in effect today. I think they have opened like one or two cinemas in the recent years. And they have also started to lift the policies in regards to women, but it is still very much strictly enforced. The teaching of non-Islamic history was also banned, and religious study was greatly expanded. And I don't have to tell you that the religion that was to be studied was, of course, Islam, specifically of the Wahhabi variety. The reasoning from the king, as well as the royals, seems to have been that they wanted to out-extremist the extremists. So if they had the most strict interpretation of Islam, then no one could sort of outflank them by being even more religious. So this, of course, led to a tightening of the grip of the religious police on Saudi citizens, as well as a tighter grip of the royal family on power. And in a lot of other states around this region, they tended to democratize, or at least on paper democratize, throughout these years, even if Egypt and Syria wasn't really that democratic in practice. At least they pretended to be. They had parliaments and they had prime ministers and things like that. But in Saudi Arabia, the royal family continued to rule supreme, even on paper, and there were very few attempts, even nominally, to appear democratic. But of course, they still had American support nonetheless. During the 80s and 90s, Saddam Hussein became a big problem for the Saudi regime. They were uncomfortable with his government, and they were all too happy to help the Americans put him down a peg in the 90s when he had invaded Kuwait. And a lot of the American and other coalition troops were stationed in Saudi Arabia. While the regime was happier with a weakened Saddam, many of the more radical elements of the country's people began to revolt against this. Most famously, Osama bin Laden, who claimed in a letter regarding the 9/11 attacks that one of the reasons for the attacks was the stationing of American troops in Saudi Arabia. And several terrorist attacks actually occurred within the kingdom itself throughout the 90s and 2000s, often directed towards Western targets, but of course also against the Saudi regime itself, since it was viewed as a puppet regime for the Americans and in the long term the Israelis, which of course were the main enemies of the radical Sunni Islamist movement. In spite of these conflicts with radical militant groups, Saudi Arabia is still seen as an ideological as well as more direct supporter of many Sunni Islamist terrorist groups, even by its close ally, the USA. And funding for mosques, radical mosques, mainly come from Saudi Arabia, even until today. Many Wahhabi mosques get their funding from Saudi Arabia. The policy of the Saudis during recent years have been dominated by a growing power contest between themselves and the Iranian regime. This has led to unlikely alliances, such as Israel and Saudi Arabia developing a working relationship, become much less hostile and even cooperating in limited ways, mainly in unofficial ways, since technically they don't have diplomatic relationships. but their common enemy, Iran, seems to have united them, at least somewhat. The Saudi regime has also made some changes as regards to human rights, especially regarding the women's driving, which was legalized a few years ago. And they have also made some minor changes in other fields. Although the Saudi regime still keeps a very tight grip on their citizens and also remain a staunch ally of the US. Although this relationship has also strained in recent years, especially in relation to Yemen, which many people in America regard as a genocide, which the backing of which is very unpopular. So this may lead to a further strain of the relationship in the future. But that is beyond my knowledge, since we're not there yet. This is all I have prepared for today. It's quite a short episode for today. This has been the History and Stuff podcast. If you like it, please leave a comment, give it a retweet, try to spread it as much as you can. And I will see you all next time. Goodbye.